Hello, I'm Tim Burrows. Now, it may not surprise you to know that at Mumbrella, we sometimes cock things up. This week, we were bamboozled by the technology. Frankly, the podcast sounds like it was recorded inside a biscuit tin. So we've decided not to put it up on Mumbrella as a proper podcast. But I listen to lots of podcasts myself, and I know how annoying it can be when one drops out of your weekly routine. So for that very small group of people who would rather have something than nothing, we've got the unedited version here. There are no stings, no jingles, none of the inserts we talk about, and we haven't deleted the bloopers and the retakes. So by all means, listen no further, and we'll be back with a proper Mumbrella cast next week, with my apologies. But if you do want to listen, here comes the un-Mumbrella cast.
Welcome to the Mumbrella cast, sponsored by Southern Cross Oz Stereo. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Robin Hicks.
This week,
the uptake of digital radio at last.
Awards ads and legitimacy.
The Hill and Knowlton versus Edelman tussle comes to an end, or does it?
Greenpeace and Solaris have it at...
Ten's plan for 2012, renovating the renovators.
Can I have that Greenpeace one again, please?
What was that?
Have it.
Oh, I'm falling into that.
Okay, here we go. Greenpeace and Solaris, have it out.
Ten's plan for 2012, renovating the renovators.
With us today in the studios of CBS Interactive, podcast producer Alice Terlikovsky.
Hi, guys.
And eardrum creative director Ralph Van Dyke.
Hello.
Now, Ralph, welcome back. Now, one thing that you've been up to since we last saw you was some work for NRMA Insurance, integrating the ads in a little bit of a different way. So let's play a couple of those examples. So that was literally where you managed to get the station to break down. It's a sort of new form of integration, really.
Yes.
Is it the first time you've done something like that?
Yeah, it is. And possibly the first time the stations have done it as well, but I just to correct you, it's not the insurance, it's the roadside assistance.
Oh yes, I always get my NRMAs confused.
Don't do that. You only make that mistake once when you're working, working with them. But no, it took a bit of arm twisting, but the sort of adage is you never mess with the music. If, in terms of integration, advertising is very hard to. Well, they try and keep them separate for obvious reasons, but I was convinced that in reality it would never sound as intrusive or as bad as they were making it out to be. So we did a demo and we got a couple of songs, and we, after the first 4 or 5 seconds, just did what you heard and broke the station down with Tim's voice, who's now associated, Rosso, he's associated with NRMA now. He comes in with a little quick message and then the song plays in full. And then we've done that with promos, station promos as well. So it's just on those stations particularly, just getting cut through is key. We achieved that with this. There's nothing more sort of attention getting than a mistake.
And did anyone say no?
They all pretty much said no.
but eventually said yes.
Yes. I wanted to do it with music across the board. Some of them are more willing to do music than others. But they're all doing something within the programming, which breaks down, which was the objective.
Yeah.
What was the feedback like from listeners? Were any listeners genuinely hoodwinked that actually the station was sort of going kaput?
Well, I think that you are for a second. I think, right. For that moment you think, oh, and there's a beat before he comes in. Yeah. And then the punchline is Tim coming in there, so I don't think anyone thinks it's a real mistake.
Right.
I think, it's one of those ideas that you can't hammer, and you can't have, on too often, because people will get a bit annoyed.
Yeah.
But for a couple of weeks to support the on-air campaign, it was a great little piece of integration.
Yes.
That I think raised a smile, and then, but as I said, if you were hearing that 4 or 5 times a day, you'd be going, oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, I was just wondering, is it a trend in radio advertising to initially sort of mislead or hoodwink the listener into thinking that it's editorial or something's happening before the reveal? Because you mentioned that the Strepsils campaign, that that you talked about in a recent podcast also involved that sort of listener sort of hoodwinking. I wondered whether that's a sort of ploy to win awards at Cannes.
No, it's just a very evil, devious way to be noticed. And it's something that we're always trying to come up with innovative ways to involve the advertiser into the programming or integrate it.
Yeah.
The strips was one, was a bit of a, you know, underhand guerrilla kind of approach. This is a legit, you know, we paid good money for this. I think it's more and more advertising needs to take the form of entertainment and work its way into that the programming side, and to be subtle about it, because if it's, you know, some of the live reads you hear are just really clunky. You know, they're talking about, you know, Gillard and trying to get some, you know, they're grilling her, and then suddenly it's all, you know, lovely roasted coffee, and it just feels completely wrong.
Yeah.
So trying to do a seamless integration into a brand, of a brand into some programming is still what we're trying to achieve, and it's a great way to support an on-air campaign.
And speaking of Strepsils, that was a campaign for those who didn't listen to the previous podcast. We were lucky enough, I think you came in the week it had just gone to air, so
yes.
You were this is where actors rang up and sort of apparently had a bit of a sore throat and had a Strepsil.
That's right, yeah.
Sort of gradually coughed away until they had their Strepsil, got the plug in. Congratulations, you did, it picked up metal at Cannes, didn't
it? Did,
it?
Yeah, which wasn't the objective, Robin. I know, I could tell that you were asking that question. It was it was nice to be rewarded there, and we've entered it into a couple of other awards, so who knows. But it was the first time it'd been done, and I'm still getting emails from people who have sort of caught on to it late and saying, you know, well done, this is a new idea.
And was that your first Lion?
No, we've won a few. We've won some with agencies where we've directed and cast their ads, and some that have work that we've generated ourselves. You know, we've written and produced it. But this was the first time it was for, an integrated piece, not a straight spot ad.
Next, digital radio. Are you listening?
Commercial Radio Australia announced this week that over 500,000 digital radio sets have been purchased since it was launched 2 years ago. This figure is said to be based on retail sales and doesn't include those in cars or units sold online. The most recent Nielsen rating suggests... Sorry. The most recent Nielsen rating survey suggested a 7.6% of radio listening now takes place on digital sets. So, Ralph, you actually worked on a campaign for Commercial Radio Australia. Let's have a listen. So, on the numbers, are you surprised at the uptake of digital radio in Australia?
No, not really. I think that it's... I was a little bit disappointed by the numbers, to be honest. I thought that it would be higher, the number of sets bought would be higher.
Right.
Anecdotally, the retailers are, you know, talking it up and talking higher numbers. I guess the GSK...
Yeah, that's right,
GSK,
yes.
Results kind of other, you know, the one everyone abides by, but so I thought that would
also
be high.
GFK, actually.
Yeah, no, that's
GSK, GFK,
right.
Which I think stands for Growth from Knowledge, someone once told
right.
me. I don't know if that's true.
That must have been what I was thinking of. So I'm not surprised by the number of people listening. Personally, we've got two digital radios at home, one at the office, and we listen, that's what we listen to the radio on. We listen to the, you know, AM stations sound lovely, and there are some of the new digital stations that we have at various times of the day, depending on, you know, the mood.
Yeah.
And so our listening habits have changed as a result. So
you think you're listening longer?
Yeah, the radio has replaced some of the things, some of the time we would have listened to, plug the iPod in or a CD or something, because some of the stations are playing the sort of music that we weren't hearing on Australian radio before. So in that way we're listening longer and to different stations. So that hasn't surprised me that there are increasing number of listeners. The devices, I think that'll come. I think what's happening, what's helping is that with the smartphones, people are looking for, you know, iPod docks or iPhone docks to be able to play some of the music that they've got on their smartphones. And if you're going to do that, you may as well buy one with a digital radio chip in it. So there's another reason to upgrade and to buy the to change your radio. In the same way as when digital TV came out, you know, you were comparing your big old clunky, you know, meter wide, meter deep TV with a lovely, you know, slick, slim, flat panel.
Right. What is it about digital radio you think consumers should be excited about? And also, why should advertisers be excited by digital radio?
Well, choice for the listeners is, I think, the driving is still the driving force behind the switch to digital. Some of the functionality is really useful too. I pause my digital radio, and if I've missed something, so I can rewind a bit. I've got one of those that does that. So that there's some functionality which is great. Sound quality, if you're listening to AM stations, then there's no comparison when you hear it on digital. But choice is really still the driving force, and I think that for advertisers that means more targeting, more opportunities to get involved in the programming because they've got more inventory to fill and more programming to involve the listener with. Involve the brand with.
Yes.
So,
okay.
So I think there's opportunities.
And I suppose for brands, it's that question of reach still, though, isn't it? You know, sort of, is it worth investing, even if the advertising inventory isn't that expensive just yet for digital, the time and effort and management in reaching a relatively small audience. I guess it feels to me like we haven't quite hit the tipping point on that yet.
No, and I don't think that'll happen until in-car and regional really kicks in. I think that'll be it's growing nicely, but for advertisers to really benefit, I think that it's going to need that extra critical mass.
What do you think the barriers are to uptake of digital radio at the moment? It's being somewhere that frankly is quite expensive to buy. Are there any other sort of barriers you think that blocking that digital radio reaching that tipping point, as you mentioned?
Well, apart from in-car, I mean, apart from the fact you can't actually listen to it in the car, and apart from the fact you can't listen to it outside of the capital cities, you mean as a consumer?
Yes.
What's stopping me from buying it? Well, it could be awareness. It could be the cost. I'd imagine that the cost is, I think, pretty key.
Yes.
I mean, there are some cheaper radios on the market. You know, $60, Harvey Norman, and there are some little portable ones that are 120, 130, and dongles you can put into your smartphone. But the prices need to come down a bit. And
yes.
I think for people to really sort of take on.
Alice. Have you bought a digital radio? Would you buy one?
I haven't bought one. To be honest, my radio listening, sorry Ralph, has reduced quite a lot since I stopped driving, because I was in Adelaide, I had my own car and I drove pretty much everywhere. Since moving to Sydney, I don't have a car, so I don't listen to the radio as much. I download podcasts and things like that, but
yeah.
I don't listen to live radio. So I haven't. You know, I haven't found a need to do it. If though, in next time I'm in the market for a car, I would be looking to have that technology incorporated into the car, so that, you know, I've got the best of the best when I'm listening.
Yes.
To the radio.
And as long as that's a BMW, you'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, I'll ask him about that. He can help me with working towards that goal.
The company car.
So, Tim, mainstream medium for digital radio, what do you think?
I mean, that's the sort... I suppose that's the question, isn't it, really, Ralph? It is... I always kind of wonder whether digital will end up being like one of those interim technologies. You know, in the end, everything will go online, and I'm sure that, you know, maybe not 10 years' time, but let's say 20 years time, everyone who's consuming radio will be in the main consuming it via online. So I suppose my question is, will digital radio will it sort of point where it becomes a mainstream medium ever actually come? I'm not sure it will.
Well, I don't think it's going to replace the current technology personally. I think it'll be another way of accessing radio content.
So you don't see a time when the FM and AM transmitters are switched off?
I think the ideal device is a hybrid. So it has FM, it has digital, and it has it's online.
Which is bad news for the radio owners if they've got to both broadcast in FM and digital, because it's almost an extra cost rather than something that will one day be replaced.
Yeah, well, I think they may not have a choice, and it may just be digital and online. But that at the moment would be the ideal device, because and then depending on what you want to do, whether you want to interact with the station, if you want to go deeper into the content, if you want to buy the track you've just heard, or you want to enter a competition, you can touch the screen and be interacting with the station's website. If you want the ubiquity of being able to access the content anywhere, then online isn't a great model because that one-to-many is very expensive for the broadcaster. So the FM and DAB then is the perfect technology for that. So I think ubiquity is key, and that's what radio, as you know, as in its current form, has over, you know, the Pandoras and the Last FMs and those guys. They can't compete with that at the moment, and until they can be everywhere on every device, and then they'll struggle.
Next, awards angst.
Sorry, can I have that again? Thanks.
Next, awards angst.
And Ralph, just to let you know, I didn't actually give you the details of this one because we hadn't actually published the story at the time. So Robin's going to give the background and ask a couple of questions.
I'll
wing it.
One of Australia's longest established ad awards is the Melbourne Advertising Design Club, the MADC. This year, one of the big names of Melbourne, GPY&R, aren't in the battle, despite winning 29 awards last year. Robin, you've been digging into this one. What's going on?
Well, what happened was that, yeah, GPY&R Melbourne have pulled out of the Melbourne Art Advertising and Design Club Awards. The ECD, Ben Coulson, he reckons that the reason they've pulled out is because the budgets, his awards budget has shrunk this year. But also because
There's another rumour in the market as well, though, on the reason why, isn't there?
Yes, yeah, there is. So the first is the shrinking awards budget, plus the fact that these awards don't count towards the Gun Report scores. So they can't bump up their rankings creatively globally.
Worth explaining for people who aren't familiar with the Gun Award, what
the Gun Report is a sort of a compilation of all the awards they've won globally, and there's a ranking system, and it's a global award scheme for ad agencies. But yeah, the second reason that the MADC thinks that GPY&R Melbourne pulled out is because they were accused of scam last year. So there's one print ads for a company called Clucky Cake Mix, a beautifully art directed award, creative work. Just so happened also that the owner of this company is related to someone at GPY&R Melbourne. So it does seem a little bit iffy. Can't go on the record and say it's definitely scam, because there's a real company called Clucky. But MADC claim that the company did not exist before they entered it in the wards. So,
they declined to have that as an entry in the end.
Yes, that's right. And that was ruled out.
It seems that an odd decision to then draw attention to that by not entering the next year. If they're allowed to enter, if they haven't been banned, if they haven't been, like, because some awards can do that, they say, well, you've been done, we won't let you enter for subsequent years or whatever. But if that hasn't been done, it seems odd to draw attention to last year's issue by not entering this year.
Yeah.
Unless they're...
And I suppose one of the questions is... I mean, Robin, I know this is a question we ask from time to time, but do you think that agencies get too serious about awards? You know, put too much time, too much effort, too much resource into winning awards, and too much weight with what comes out at the other end?
No, I don't. I think that, obviously they're valuable currency. They help hire, attract good creatives. I think they're very important for agencies. But agencies think that, obviously, clients don't care about them, I don't think, as much, anywhere near. So in the wider world, they're not important, but creative agencies, they are very key, and I think rightly so.
I slightly disagree with the approach that clients don't care about them. I agree they don't care about them as much. But, you know, you win an award, the client is over the moon. We went out for lunch last week with the Strepsils client. They were thrilled. They want a copy of the duplicate of the trophy.
Which is where Karen makes some of its money,
exactly,
isn't it? That's our chief, aren't
they? No, I told them how much it was. Suddenly that went bang with the champagne that we had lined up. They want to win an award. Awards represent creative, a reward for creative thinking. and they want their agency to be innovative and to be hungry and to want to push the boundaries and do their job, which is to, you know, create attention getting campaigns that have cut through. So and if awards is the motivating factor for the creative to actually work harder, try harder and push further, then they'll be right behind it.
Yeah, but of course it's another matter when an agency is striving so much for awards glory that they create work that isn't actually real.
I take huge exception to that. I think I really hate it when I see that, because it's not, you know, a level playing field. And if you're creating the client or creating the environment that it ran, I mean, there's all sorts of stories about outdoor running in the agency's car park and things like that, which is just, you know, rubbish.
It seems to be in
defence of GPY&R, I think one of the arguments they've been making on this one is they were ruled against, but they feel that it was a legitimate ad, which I suspect is part of the annoyance on their part.
Yeah, to be honest, in defence of GPY&R, I've been in to see them recently. They're an excellent agency that pumps out some world-class work, one of the best agencies in Melbourne and Australia. So it seems a bit little odd that they would resort to scam, if indeed it was scam. On media, it seems that scam tends to be confined to print, and as you mentioned, outdoor. What about radio? Scam and radio?
Yeah, it happens. You know, you can have an ad running in the middle of the night on a dodgy, you know, community station, and it's suddenly eligible for every award in the country. The Siren Awards in Australia, the ad has to be broadcast on one of their Commercial Radio Australia partner stations at least, I think, 10 or 20 times. So it needs to have had a media schedule. So at least that sort of, you know, mitigates some of those problems. But for Cannes, for example, the ad can run once in the middle of the night, and as long as the client's approved the actual creative and knows about it, then it's eligible. But you can tell, you know, you hear the ad and suddenly it's, you know, featuring characters that could never be in a radio ad or against sometimes the advertising regulations. And it's pretty apparent to everyone whether it actually ran or whether the advertiser would have signed that off.
Yeah, because usually with a print ad, you can tell it's scam. It's beautifully art directed, beautifully photographed.
It's the first giveaway.
But with a tiny little logo in the bottom right hand corner, and it's fairly obvious. There's a formula to scam work, it seems. But in radio, you mentioned it's easy to spot, but the actual creative execution can, to the judge's ear, is it obvious?
I think so. They look at the brand. And then they look at the actual work, the job that the ad would have done, or in most cases wouldn't have done. And you think, would the client have signed that off? Would they have been prepared to invest money in an on-air campaign that represents their brand like this? And then the answer's, you know, pretty obvious.
Next, a CEO's apology.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all these stories, visit mumbrella.com.au. This week, Edelman's Michelle Hutton and Anna McIntosh signed letters of apology to former employer Hill & Knowlton. They read, Following my departure from Hill & Knowlton Australia, I was involved in soliciting certain clients and staff of H&K. This occurred in the course of my employment by Edelman Public Relations Worldwide. I recognise that my conduct was not appropriate in the circumstances, and I apologise to H&K unreservedly. This letter was published on the Hill & Knowlton website and also sent to us, and we assume other trade press. So, Tim, tell us about this one. What's it all about?
Yeah, partly the message is don't mess with Martin Sorrell. You know, not the first time that a former member of staff used to work for WPP and works for somebody else finds themselves in a legal battle. Fair to say that the Sorrell spirit, the WPP spirit, is very much about if you feel that you have legal rights, you're going to enforce them vigorously. Now, obviously, what we don't know is what actually went on during the settlement. Clearly, Hill & Knowlton felt that after their staff left, something in their contracts had suggested that they couldn't have certain contacts with former colleagues, with former clients, for a period of time. And certainly that apology seems to suggest that there was some sort of inappropriate behaviour. But at the same time, it's what's not there. You know, it would certainly appear that if there had been damages paid or something like that, then usually there would be some sort of form of words in the announcement suggesting that. There's nothing that talks about whether each side paid their own costs, for instance, which would perhaps be my guess. So it looks like, you know, WPP have got enough out of it to say at the end, well, look, we got the apology. It's very reminiscent of when, through Y&R, WPP bought George Patterson, created GP Y&R, and there were some messy legal issues around staff leaving who sort of in the months that followed the deal, who it appeared had been persuaded to stay for a certain time, and the argument was whether WPP had been made aware that they were only locked in for a certain period of time. So again, it went legal, but the final thing, and this is where it starts to look familiar, was letters of apology, public apology to, you know, to the agency. So quite a similar outcome again. I think the other thing that maybe just adds a bit of a freezing to it, and this, it'd be good to get Alice's view on this as well, is that certainly my sense is Edelman, under this new management, now led by Michelle Hutton, who, you know, had worked for about 19 years with Hill & Knowlton, it feels to me like that's an agency that's got momentum, whereas I'm actually not sure what's going on at Hill & Knowlton. It feels like the management keeps changing. For a long period, there was an acting MD in Sue Cook, who now has been confirmed as MD. But you don't get the sense in the same way that that is, you know, an agency that's got the same momentum that Edelman has at the moment. I mean, Alice, you go in and see these agencies. PR's one of your beats. Do you get that sense, or am I being a bit unfair?
Look, I'll have a disclaimer here. I'm still very much learning on the topic, but certainly the disruptions between staffing there, like you mentioned with Sue Cook being acting MD and then becoming MD, you know, I made a phone call and it was, oh, okay, she's now MD. Okay, all right, we'll include that in the story, and various different position changes. And, you know, that, especially on a website like Mumbrella, when we report all these things, it's pretty easy to type in Hill & Knowlton and you can see, you know, in the archive what's been going on, and it's pretty plain to see. What I'm unsure about, and the biggest question mark over my head with this is this particular instance, is them publishing the apology letters on their website. I don't know what that's going to achieve in terms of for clients. I don't see, you know, what are they trying to say? We got them, and we know that our clients spoke to her, so don't you dare do it again? Like, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I remember, Tim, you bristling at that. You pulled the website and you're like, oh my God, yeah, you know, they're making quite a meal of this. But
it's on the global website.
Yeah, on the global website.
Wasn't just the local
one.
It's
PR.
One.
It's an image game, right?
Mm.
You want to get as much mileage as possible about the fact that one of your rivals has perhaps behaved.
Has done you wrong, allegedly.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that in that industry, that perception is everything. And if they believe Edelman has... or the individuals have breached their contract, then that'll raise question marks over the way they do business. It just, and I'm sure that was their objective.
Mm. Yeah, I guess it's likely that more people that will look at that website will be PR professionals rather than clients. Or if you were a client, Ralph, and you were to look at Hill & Knowlton's website, what do you think of the fact that they've got an apology published on their homepage?
Yeah, I mean, it's... Hill & Knowlton can never win out of this situation.
Right.
The more they blow it up, and the more press that is generated over this, the more awareness there is over Edelman in the first place. You know, a couple of clients who have never heard of them have now heard of them, albeit with a slightly tarnished reputation. But you know, there's an awareness that people have a very short memory about these things. As a client, I think. That there's something going on at Hill & Knowlton, which is I should wait till it's settled down before I consider being a part of that company.
And you're right about people having short memories, though. I've got a funny feeling that give it another 3 months and nobody will even remember that this happened.
No.
Next, Greenpeace and Solaris have it out.
There's been quite a feud going on between Greenpeace, and Greenpeace does like its feuds, and paper company Solaris here in Australia. But there's been a bit more to it this week than we originally thought. Robin, this was a story that you kicked off from Umbrella. Maybe shed some light on some of the backstory.
Yeah, we originally ran a story based on a press ad that Solaris ran in the Daily Telegraph. Basically, the ad was, I guess it was extending the hand of friendship to Greenpeace and explain its sustainability policy.
Solaris being a paper company.
Yeah, Solaris is the Australian arm of a massive logging firm, paper company called Asia Pulp and Paper. As a journalist, I find it very hard to be objective about this company, but perhaps I'll come on to that later. So anyway, this ad, the press ad that they ran, also complains about Greenpeace targeting IGA, a big supermarket in Australia, which is supplied paper to make toilet roll by Solaris. Greenpeace responded to the ad saying that this was greenwash. And we ran a story on that, and as Tim, as you know very well, it led to a number of rather vicious comments made about Greenpeace, and in particular one of Greenpeace's campaigners. Tim, do you want to take over and explain what happened?
So it got to the point where there were so many comments, all of a very similar tone. And you kind of usually get a sense with Umbrella when it's people from within the media and marketing industry. And sometimes what happens is, for whatever reason, a particular story, usually it's a TV story, will appear particularly well on Google. Members of the public will come in and, you know, you can feel the tone change, and usually it's people complaining about Rescue Special Ops being cancelled or something like that, and you'll see a long run of comments. So my initial thought was that actually it's just a different, maybe slightly more kind of anti-environmentalist or anti-Greenpeace leading audience than the one that would usually come in. But the comments get coming and coming and coming. So what we sometimes do, when it becomes suspicious of comments, is have a look at the IP address, where they're coming from. And what became fairly clear fairly quickly was there appeared to be two groups of comments. One, all of them quite similar in tone, actually, in both groups, tended to be extensive use of the caps lock, quite angry. But there was a group of three that particularly took against a campaigner from Greenpeace, and after he'd joined in the conversation thread, became very personal about him, describing him as scum, that sort of thing. And I looked up the IP address that we had, which you can just, if you want to find out how to do that, you look in the back end, you see what the IP address is, you then tap into Google the words, something like reverse IP lookup or something like that, and it'll tell you if that IP address happens to be publicly registered to someone, and it was publicly registered to Solaris. So clearly somebody at Solaris had posted those three. The other 20, all from another IP address, who that IP address appears to be a service provided by Telstra, so it could be anyone, as far as we know. Similar in tone, but all we know is that there was somebody pretended to be 20 different people. Each one was posting in a different name, all taking broadly the same point of view, but sometimes male, sometimes female. One point they gave themselves quite a similar description in a name to one of the three that had come from the Solaris thing, but that could have been coincidence. They could have seen it, put it, so we don't know. But anyway, we went public on that. We do say in our privacy conditions that if someone tries to mislead our readers, we reserve the right to look at IP addresses and make it public if we feel our readers are being misled. So that has led to, I understand, some quite big internal ructions at Solaris. Again, I understand that the person who did it put their hand up to those three messages, took responsibility. Someone quite senior, they're treating it quite seriously. Their corporate comms guy is headed back to Australia from his holiday. We spoke to him while he was on his holiday, and he's probably, as we speak, he's on a plane on the way back from Bali. Solaris have issued something of an apology, saying that the behaviour was inappropriate and unprofessional.
Interesting what Greenpeace is going to do now, of course. Chatting to Greenpeace yesterday, they've got a budget of $40,000 annually to spend on communications. That's their forestry division that's handling this one. It costs Solaris $60,000 to place a single ad, well, that's rate card, to place a single ad in the Daily Telegraph. So with limited budget, it'll be interesting to see how Greenpeace plays this. Obviously, they will use this to their advantage.
I think they've already won.
They have won, but they want to bash Solaris as hard as they possibly can. And it'll be interesting to see how they play it. Obviously, their budget's small. All they've done so far is issue a press release. And with limited budget, I wonder what they can do. Social media, perhaps. They've used above the line advertising recently. In my opinion, not to great effect. Some of the advertising work they've done has been fairly shoddy. So yeah, be interesting to see how they play it.
Well, I think leave it to Solaris to continue to shoot themselves in the foot, I think would be the first tactic.
I guess almost the harder question is if you were Solaris, if you were the corporate communications director of Solaris, or if you were from PPR, the agency that's advising them, the PR agency that's advising them, what would you advise them to do? What would you do, you know, if you were trying to deal with that issue?
Well, I think they've done as much as they can so far, which is to front up, sort of give a half apology and hope that it blows over. But
what about the sort of wider thing of, you know, the fact that they're in Greenpeace's targets? Because I think the debate was, should they have placed that ad or not? To me, actually, I thought they were better off placing the ad than not, because, you know, they were responding to something that was bubbling along.
I think they should have kept their heads down, to be honest. I think they drew attention to themselves by running that ad in the first place.
Yeah, I think it adds weight to the criticisms that Greenpeace have laid to them by running the ad. I would have had very clear statements which took maybe three or four of the main points from that press ad as a public statement and said, look, this is what we're doing, these are the realities, you know, this is how we support the industry, and this is what we're doing proactively to help protect these endangered animals, and then leave it at that, personally, because it's now exploded.
Yes, I'll be meeting with PPR, their PR agency, next week to have a chat with them about it. But interesting on Asia Pulp and Paper, this is a company that's affiliated with Solaris. In Indonesia, they had a pitch for their advertising accounts, and I remember two advertising agencies declining to pitch for APP because they strenuously objected to their policies.
Well, the question is, was it objection to the policies, or was it fear of being seen to be involved with those, you know, in the same way that you get some ad agencies that probably love the tobacco money but don't want the hassle that goes with it.
Yeah, they didn't want to be. Actually, it was objecting. I mean, APP actually doesn't have the brand problem in Indonesia that it does in Australia. But yeah, it was objecting. I interviewed the chap, it's below, I think, that he said, yeah, I don't want to be associated with a company that's ripping down Indonesian rainforest.
Next, renovating the renovators, and more from
Cleared that up.
Yeah. Good blooper.
I just should stick to the script rather than try and add things to it. Next, renovating the renovators and TEN's plans for 2012.
TEN announced its programming for 2012 this week, with one announcement that everyone was expecting and one that they were perhaps not. The industry's worst-kept secret was that TEN were entering the breakfast show battle with new show Breakfast. Andrew Rochford has been announced as host. The other, which may surprise some, is that they were signed on for another series of The Renovators, which we know hasn't fared well in its first season. TEN's boss of programming, David Mott, said they were currently rejigging the format for this series as well as next. So Alice, you're at the press conference. Any surprises with new programmes for TEN?
One that they did announce was the revival of Young Talent Time, that will return in a sense to the screens next year. Johnny Young is supposedly not going to be involved in front of the camera, but he is going to be a co-executive producer on the show. It'll be hosted by Rob Mills, who was of Australian Idol fame quite a few years ago. So
and isn't he famous? Isn't he famous for something else now as well?
Probably.
I was asking around at the after party afterwards. I'm told that there was a liaison with Paris Hilton. Was the other?
No, at the Melbourne Cup a couple of years ago too. I think.
Apparently so. This was the when I was asking someone who's only been in the country about 5 years. I was having to ask that question of, you know, who's Rob Mills.
Yeah, well, I remember him from a more innocent occasion of Australian Idol. But yeah, you're right. That I think there was a liaison with Paris.
So he's the one that had the liaison with Paris.
Yeah, the only one, exactly. And then there was also Reef Doctors, which is going to be starring Lisa McCune.
Is that about mending coral reefs?
Let's hope so. Maybe Greenpeace could get involved, Robin. But, you know, it's another kind of water-based show that Lisa McCune, she's actually producing this as well, and she's starring in it. So, I don't know, it kind of screams of, what's the Nine show that she's in? Sea Patrol, but with, animals and stuff.
Critically ill reef.
What? What are you guys laughing at?
Just the idea of, you know, the emergency phone call comes in each week. The reef's broken again.
We've got a sprained reef. We've got to take her in.
I think they're pitching it as a...
I just can't wait for the dramatic music that's going to accompany the, you know, pink piece of coral in their hand. I think we've lost it.
I'm just thinking the theme tune. You could just like rework Ghostbusters, but instead who are you going to call Reef Doctors?
Out of the way, I'm a reef doctor.
Yeah.
So Ralph, out of that lineup, or is anything in particular on telly that you're drawn towards?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me this question because last time I was here you asked me about MasterChef. Cooking and DIY are the things that I really hate just because I'm crap at them. And so I don't watch any DIY programs or any cooking programs, so I'm afraid...
Which doesn't leave you much to schedule.
No, exactly. And so I'm a bit stuffed. But... the things I do watch are, you know, thank God for my IQ, because I can catch things like Graham.
Your Foxtel IQ?
Yes.
Or
my IQ. I don't thank God for that IQ. That's why I'm an advertiser. Arrested Development, Modern Family, Graham Norton, QI. I mean, if I'm going to watch anything, it'll be those things. All the box sets
and
of whatever it is.
Funny you should mention
Graham Norton.
Saturday nights on 10 in the new schedule.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Saturday nights on 10. Well, there you go. In answer to your question, I'm really happy that Graham Norton's coming to Channel 10 on Saturday night.
So, Tim, you're at the launch. Any standouts for you?
Yeah, a couple of interesting ones. One of them I think is going to be interesting is a sort of telly movie, Underground, which is going to be the Julian Assange story, sort of going back to when he was... he was a hacker in Melbourne in, I think, the early 80s.
Yeah, he's 18.
Yes, he was under the name of, I think, Mendax was his name. There's a book about it, which I think is out of print, although I'm sure that'll be coming back to print quite soon. So that's one standout. Bikey Wars is another one, which as one of the things, as I was kind of arriving at the event, kind of up and down the street, as far as you see, there were loads of bikes and bikies. And I assumed it was some other event, but they had after the launch at the Sydney Theatre Company, people then sort of could either walk the 100 metres or so to the after party or get a ride on one of the bikes. So they pulled out the stops there, and the other thing they pulled out the stops were it was an outstanding, I won't say gift bag really because it's a bit larger than the gift bag. All of the guests were leaving with a television tucked under their arm.
I wonder where they got that from.
Yeah, so
the shards of glass.
Well, that was the thing. Yeah, one of the reasons, other than the fact that I have two televisions, which is quite enough for one person, was the fact that I just felt that I would look like some sort of looter walking through the streets of Sydney. So
isn't they did a contra deal with the bikie games? Robin, I can't believe you said that.
Yeah.
and the bikies in question, I have to say, did look very respectable. So I think they weren't so much. They were more. I would put them down on the bike enthusiast rather than bikie gang side of the equation.
Nice cover then.
Yeah. the other show which I thought got a big reaction when it was showed to the guests was they sort of did extended sort of highlights from it's Zoe Deschanel, I believe, her or something like that, her name is pronounced, a comedy from the US called New Girl, which I think there's already been a full 22 episodes commissioned in the US, but they've clearly got big hopes. I grabbed a quick chat with David Mott, the programming director, sort of later in the evening, and he was saying it's the closest thing that he's seen to Friends in terms of, you know, audience reaction and what people kind of think of it and how they sort of warm to it. So I think there's a few there.
You mentioned just earlier on that David Mott had an air of confidence about him in the programming schedule or what Ten's got to offer. Do you have confidence in him and Ten that they can actually deliver?
Yeah, it's funny because simply because the Block's done really well on Nine and the Renovators hasn't done so well, suddenly there's almost the assumption that he's suddenly become an idiot. But the thing is, whenever you launch a big show, there's an element of risk. They took a big risk with MasterChef and it paid off. They took a big risk with the Renovators and it hasn't, probably insert the word yet, paid off. And again, you know, in his presentation, he kind of made the point, we need to fix it, we're going to fix it, and they've commissioned another series as well. So showing their kind of commitment. But yeah,
well, it's been bubbling along at about, I think last count was 700,000. Is that a failure? Or is that a solid platform to build on?
I think for the investment, it's a failure. I mean, you want above a million. You know, it's in the slot that MasterChef was consistently delivering, sort of 1.3, 1.4. But the problem is it's sort of dragging down the rest of the schedule at the moment. The big test is this weekend, the Block's final. So will the Renovation fans decide that they have got room in their lives for one Renovation show and move across? So we might see it improve some yet. We may see them make tweaks during this series. In fact, we will see them make tweaks during this series. And then we'll see them come back with something different next time. So yeah, no, he kind of... it's a hard job though, isn't it? 8:30 every morning, the ratings come in and you know whether you've won or lost. That's pretty tough.
Mm. Do you sense that they're sticking with the same demographic? Obviously, Ten's got a certain viewer profile. Do you think they're sticking with that, or is there any sense that they're moving away, perhaps diversifying a little?
No, they're very much making a lot at the event of the demos. I guess you get Nine kind of bangs the drum for 18-49. Ten was sort of saying, okay, well, one, since they've repositioned that as male 18-49, so that's where they go head to head with Nine. For Ten, they're saying 16-39. Presumably, they, at the press briefing you were at, it was the same thing, Alice.
Yeah, and also with one, they're also going up against. I'm not sure of their targeted demographic, but 7-8, of course, if they're talking about
similarly blokey.
Yeah.
And guys, any sense from advertisers as to, did you meet any advertisers? Did you chat to any clients as to what was their response to the lineup?
Yeah, I had a good chat with a few people actually. Interesting talking to a few media guys. They're all pretty happy. The one interesting thing was Kylie Rogers, head of sales for Ten, kind of said in her little bit from the stage, at the moment you're giving us a 30 share with this, we've got to be worth more. So I was asking quite a few people, are they worth a 30 share? You're going to give them a 30 share, and it was interesting because I was talking to one or two people from sort of, you know, smaller media agencies who were kind of saying to me, well, you know, actually with some clients we already give them more than that, you know, because it you know, younger target skews that way. But one or two of the bigger guys, including someone from arguably the biggest agency, was
right.
You know, he was impressed with what he thought, but he thought by what he saw, but it was, yeah, they could probably only give him 30 share.
Yeah, and if you were James Warburton, the incoming CEO, would you be concerned, having witnessed what you did last night?
Well, would I be concerned? This week my company announced a 20% drop in profit.
I think he'd be quite relieved that he didn't start 6 months ago.
Yeah, no, that's very true. You know, massively more competitive environment. We're yet to see whether it's a stable group of shareholders. You know, it's not going to be all plain sailing for him, but you know, that's why they've paid so much for him, because you know, he's probably the right guy for what's going to be a very, very tough job.
Go, Tim.
Oh, is it me?
Yeah, that's what I have time for today.
Well, that's all we have time for today. A big thank you to Ralph Van Dyke.
You're welcome.
To Robin Hicks.
Cheers, Tim.
And to Alice Terlikovsky.
Thanks, guys.
That was the Mumbrella Cast, recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle pip.